When friends get together, they blether. And when these two friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions.
Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues.
We hope that you enjoy listening to our podcast and you could join in our blethers on social media. You can find us at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and we'd love it if you could share them with your friends and maybe leave a review on the platform of your choice. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether. Hello and welcome to episode 9 of series 3 of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston.
And we were spending the last episode looking at the growth of the metropolis, the Jutopolis of Dundee, the jam, jute and journalism, how it made it wealthy and really put Dundee on the map.
Yes, and you know, this wealth was not without its problems and hindrances and disasters really, Liz. One of the main ones that I think most of our listeners will have heard of is the Tay Bridge disaster that took place in 1879. And this was when they were building the railways, trying to run a railway right up the east side of Scotland. They built the Tay Bridge across the Firth of Tay, the wide stretch of water. And that opened in the 1878. And a year later was the disaster. A train came down during a storm. So that was something that was a big thing, and people quite often associate Dundee with that disaster.
And the controversy still goes on today because the designer of the Tay Bridge was a man called Thomas Bouch, and he was hailed by Queen Victoria as a wonder when it opened in the summer. But then the last day of the year, when the train tumbled into the water below as the bridge gave way, he was vilified, and his own son-in-law was actually lost in the disaster. And so he died a broken man. And the outcome of that was that the bridge that he was supposed to build over the Firth of Forth, the contract was not given to him. So some people say that he was forced to try and make savings. And he always maintained that it wasn't the bridge that was the problem, it was the rails. So it's still, people argue on both sides of that today.
Yes, I think probably current thinking is it was they minimised the expense on the materials. They used the wrong materials because they were cheaper.
Yeah, he had a reputation for being able to bring projects in under budget. And I think he was put under great pressure for that. But that was one disaster. Another one, terrible disaster, because 2 million gallons of whiskey went up in flames or down the drain as they ran down the street.
Yes, the Watson's Bond went up in flames, and it was huge. It was millions of pounds worth of damage. But you can imagine there was whiskey barrels, whiskey going up there. There was champagne being stored in the warehouse. There was everything. And there was just, it sounded like a war zone, people said, because the amounts of popping bottles and, you know, explosions going on. And the whiskey that did escape was running down the street like rivers in the street. Now, I don't know whether they were, you know, rivers that were alight or whether people were out there with their buckets, I'm not sure. But it, also the sparks then set alight a jute warehouse as well. So it was just a memorable thing, but a lot of big loss. So again, the beginning of a downfall.
Yeah, that was 1906. But, you know, it was still going strong. And even in the interwar years, you know, Dundee was at the centre of innovation and development. Remembering that town planner, the town architect, James Thompson, he was responsible for a revolutionary housing scheme in Logie, an area of Dundee. So in 1920s, the Logie Council Housing Scheme was the first of its kind in Europe. You know, before that, you'd had the tenements and the workers' cottages, but this was completely revolutionary. These were blocks of four flats, and they formed a tree-lined avenue, just like the upmarket villas of the jute barons that we heard about last time. They had central heating, which came from a municipal heating system. So, I mean, huge advances, the Scotland's first municipal housing scheme. In fact, it was so good that the workers never got to live in them because they were immediately bought up by the middle classes. So kind of defeated the purpose, but a real success story.
Yeah, I remember my parents, you know, growing up and going back to Dundee, that it would be said, oh, we're going to see so-and-so, she lives in Logie. You know, it was a big sort of accolade, a feather in the cap to live in Logie. Yeah. Yes, and you know, other things were happening in Dundee. There were various things happening. They were just trying to build things up and make things look good. And one thing happened in 1938, which was a record-breaking flight, an aviation flight. They had been trying to get from Dundee to Cape Town in South Africa, but they realised that they were using, this was with the seaplane, and they were using a great amount of fuel in the takeoff. So they devised this idea of piggybacking a smaller plane on top of a bigger plane. And so the smaller plane did not use any fuel in takeoff. The bigger plane did that. So on the Firth of Tay, just outside Dundee, this strange contraption, the big seaplane with a little seaplane on top, took off. And when they reached the given height, the little seaplane, Mercury, flew off to Cape Town. Didn't quite make the flight all the way to Cape Town, came down only about 200 miles short, but it's a record that still stands to this day.
Yep,
and that was in 1938.
Yep, there's a wee commemorative plaque there next to the Discovery Centre that talks about this world long distance aviation record. So, you know, Dundee was on the map. It was firmly established. But then came the Second World War. And at the end of the Second World War, it was a completely different world. We saw how the jute industry had collapsed. We saw how Keilers had moved their production away from Dundee. And it was a city that was beginning to go into decline. A lot of poverty, a lot of deprived areas. And after the end of World War II, there was a policy of decentralising industry. And so Dundee received what was known as development area status. Now, it's a bit like the city regions today. If you have that status, then money pours into that area to try and create employment. And that's what it was like in Dundee. The money came in, it gave incentives, but it also set up the first industrial estates that we were to see spread across Scotland.
Yes, and with these industrial estates, they were again thinking of the planning and how it was going to be laid out. So they built a road, a kind of a bypass, the Kingsway, round Dundee, and they put most of the factories, most of the industry on the other side of that road. So the residential areas of Dundee were on one side of the Kingsway and the industrial sites were on the other side. It's semi-works today, but there's been residential sites built on the other side as well today. But I think, Liz, you worked on the other side of the Kingsway at one point.
I did. I mean, my career before guiding, life before guiding, was in education. And at one point, very briefly, I moved out to be head of science at Kingsway College, which had previously been Kingsway Tech, now part of Dundee College. But times had changed. I mean, my whole emphasis in the area was trying to bring in people who needed to develop skills but had no prior qualifications, so widening access, as it's called, trying to bring them in to study in the college to try and get new skills. But of course, the Dundee Tech had been built for skills for all these new industries attracted to the city. So it was very old and traditional. There were bottles of acid sitting out in all the chemistry labs, totally contrary to COSH requirements, health and safety requirements. So it was quite a challenge trying to change attitudes within the college. And I didn't last there long before I moved into widening access proper and moved into the university sector. But for a year and a bit, I did travel up the road every day on the Kingsway to Kingsway Tech, now Dundee College.
Yes, and it's still a main artery to get across Dundee, the Kingsway. But some of the new industries that came in, there were some well-known names of the time. There was Timex watches. Well, that came in as under another name, as a time company. And there was the battery company, Vidor Batteries. There was NCR, National Cash Registers. So all of them came in at this time, always at all attracted by some sort of inward investment.
Yeah, these are the ones that you've mentioned there, Helen, are all North American multinationals. And you can think, why after the war were North American multinationals coming to Dundee of all places? But there was a variety of reasons. First of all, there was the Marshall Plan in the United States, which was trying to create jobs and develop Western Europe. So there was incentives both at home, but also there was major incentives to come to Dundee. Not least of all, the fact that Dundee has the longest daylight hours. It's one of the sunniest places. And so that was thought to help productivity. And of course, you've got all these incentives that are being offered by the development area. Incentives in terms of grants, incentives in terms of land to build on. And so over they came and they started to form these light engineering companies. And we'll come back and talk about a few of them because I think there's some quite interesting stories there. They had people who had already developed the skills from the jute industry, but now they transferred these skills into these new technologies. And bit by bit, they began to employ the population of Dundee, till about 12% of people were found in employment in these companies out on these new industrial estates. So the employment in textiles was overtaken by the employment in engineering. And one of these was slipperine. Now, I know that you've got a story about slipperine, Helen.
Well, I'm sure I thought everybody knew about slipperine, but that was one of the main things that you had to think about if you're going to dances or holding dances. When we were at school, we used to put on a Christmas dance or a leavers dance each year. Once you were in fifth and sixth year, you would do that. And in our days, we used to hire the drill hall, which is where the territorial army would practice. But it was a lovely big hall, but it wasn't very good for dancing. The wooden floor was a bit sticky. So slipperine was what you sprinkled all over the floor, and then you scooshed around it, glided around it, trying to make it slippy. So you had to get it just right, Liz. If you put too much slipperine on, it was like dancing on an ice rink. If you put too little, it was kind of like your foot would stick as you were doing these wonderful pally glides, etc.
Yeah, this was the transfer from the days of the jigs and wherever, where you lifted your feet high, to exactly what you're saying. You're gliding the pally glide, and you've got mirror balls and chiffon dresses all dancing around. And so this was a local homegrown industry. It started in 1868 when a man called William Jobson, he was a druggist and dry salter. He sold medications, but also any dry goods, any dry chemicals. And he sold those in Dundee. And he observed that when the people were going to the local dance halls, the surface that they were dancing on was either wood, but more often stone or brick. And so that was no good whatsoever for these gliding steps. So he realised that if you put a liquid onto it, it would just simply soak into the surface of it. So he experimented and experimented until he came up with exactly the right formula. It looked a bit like grainy mustard. It was the same colour and the same texture. But when it dried to a sort of varnish. And that was fantastic when it came to slipping over the floor, so which is why it was called slipperine. And word spread, and before long, not just from Scotland, but from all over the world, there was orders coming in On one occasion, he got an order of 7 pounds of slipperine from Lahore in Malaysia, and it had to be sent urgently. It had to be sent by air. And he was a bit curious, so he phoned up to find out what this order was all about. And he found out that it was for the Sultan's palace in Lahore. Johor, it's not Lahore, it's Johor, J-O-H-O-R-E in Malaysia. And the Sultan was in a bit of a paddy because he had this wonderful dance floor, but the Queen was coming. And everybody knows that the Queen was a fantastic dancer. So when she went out around the Commonwealth, you know, she was seen gliding across the floor, and his wooden floor was a wee bit sticky. So he wanted to get the slipperine down before the Queen arrived.
Yeah, well, it's funny because you obviously the grainy mustard, you know, product was something that you put on as a kind of a commercial thing. But when you were just doing it for one dance, it came in a, it was like the granules, and you just sprinkled it over. You know, you get this shake and vac or something for your carpet. The same idea. You just shook it all over the floor, and then you spread it in by just doing all your pirouettes and dances to make it work. Good stuff.
During the war, they couldn't get the material to colour it, this mustardy yellow. And so it changed to a pink colour. And after the war, when the material became available again, there was great outcry. No, no, we don't want the yellow stuff. We want the pink stuff. So it remained pink slipperine.
Actually, you're right, because I do remember it coming out as pink granules.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you're lucky that you didn't live in the days when it was a mustard yellow. But through time, 1976, I mean, the company is still going strong today. It's the fourth generation. But in 1976, one of the directors of the company was travelling out of Glasgow for St John's in Nova Scotia, and he was on the Donaldson's line. And when they got to sea, it was really, really rough, and the passengers were all locked up in their cabins. And so once the storm abated, they thought, well, let's get the passengers out and about. We'll invite them on deck for a game of quoits. But when the director of the slipperine company looked at the boards, he thought, no, you're not going to get quoits on here, because the quoits would never slide across this wet wood. But no problem. He says, I've got a tin of slipperine. And so the problem was averted.
Oh, that's great. That's a nice story. Yes, it's amazing. I'd forgotten all about slipperine until we started doing this, Liz. So it's good.
It was one of the success stories from a homegrown company. But of course, most of these companies were American that moved in. And one of them was, as you say, Vidor, which moved in to start to produce dry batteries in 1941. And it became the largest dry battery manufacturing plant in Europe. And Dundee earned the reputation of the manufacturing centre of Europe for these dry batteries. In 1961, the factory employed over 100 people. It went through several changes of ownership. It moved from the dry batteries into lithium ion batteries, first of all for mobile phones. And of course, nowadays, as we move into hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles, it was going strong in the production of lithium batteries for cars. But in 2016, the story of Dundee, the factory moved away, it moved to Milton Keynes, but it still continued because one of the managers of the company set up his own small company producing high-tech batteries. And in fact, they've actually a very interesting one. They signed a memorandum of understanding with an Indian technology company to explore e-rickshaws in India.
Oh, my goodness.
Still going strong. And there were plans for a £190 million gigafactory, which would really have transformed employment in Dundee at the moment. 215 jobs formed with an additional 800. But unfortunately, that company went into administration late in December 2023. So this is sort of the rise and fall of Dundee. Great success stories followed by stories of despair.
Yes, but you know, you had other companies which had interesting stories. The Levi jeans came to Dundee. That was very different from the jute industries and the jam and the journalism. Levi jeans, still pretty centred on women workers though, wasn't it?
Yes, but then another of these high-tech companies, the beginning of refrigerators. 1953, the Astral company revolutionised the market with silent refrigerators, you know, so you could keep your food fresh for longer, buys for days ahead. So that was the marketing. But one of the things I like about their marketing was that it weren't just about reducing food waste. in their marketing, when they were advertising it, one of the biggest claims was there was no interference with your television. So, you know, okay to keep your food fresh, but don't mess with the telly.
Yeah, but it's funny because in those days, fridges were just not in people's houses. I mean, people would not even think about having a kitchen without a fridge now. But I remember my parents' first fridge came from off a boat that was being refurbished in Glasgow in the docks, in the shipyards. And it was an old Kelvinator fridge.
Yeah.
I mean, the size inside was minuscule. The size of the fridge was massive because of all the insulation that they had to use.
Yeah, and of course the name Kelvin from Lord Kelvin.
Yes.
Thermal and all of that associated with Glasgow, yeah. Another one that everybody had was a Timex watch. Their slogan was, "It takes a licking and it keeps on ticking." And that was an American company that came into Dundee after the war. New alloys that they could make robust watches with. They had to be accurate, but they also had to be durable. And most importantly, they had to be inexpensive. Not like the high-priced Swiss watches that were the norm at that time.
Yes, because everybody at school had a Timex watch. That's what you got for Christmas or your birthday, was when you were old enough to have a watch. They even produced one that helped you to learn to read the time. This was the days before digital. Mm-hmm. So you actually had to understand the hands going round and the numbers 1 to 12 and what they meant. But they had a little one, I think it was a red and blue face, that helped you to read the time.
Yep, and another success story, NCR, National Cash Registers, another American company, came in 1945. The reasons that it gave for choosing Dundee was its good rail network and also the lack of damage that it had sustained during World War II. So, you know, there was a good available pool of workers with engineering skills. So they came to NCR and were a great success. At their peak, they employed more than 6,000 people in the early 1970s.
Yes, and one of the things that they're sort of remembered for is the work they did, the development they did on bringing in what we call the hole in the wall, but I think some of our listeners might know more about it as an ATM machine. And they worked very hard to produce the right technology so that we could all get money out of the hole in the wall.
Yeah, and it was at one point the NCR factory, although it was there for 75 years, eventually at that point it was in danger of closing because they'd done several prototypes of the ATM, but they hadn't been successful. And by the 1970s, we're seeing huge competition from Japan with its digital technologies and from the Far East. And so they were given 6 months. If they didn't come up with a new plan for the ATM and it wasn't successful, it would have closed. But thanks to the innovation of the people of Dundee, they pooled together and they came up with this state-of-the-art ATM that was to be the leader in its field for many years.
Yes, and you know, we were just talking earlier, Liz, about what it was like before you could actually go to the hole in the wall, especially at weekends, you know, where you needed some money. You think, how on earth do you get money out? And do you remember one of the ways of doing it, Liz? Oh, you're too young to remember.
I remember it well.
you used to go and buy something out of Marks and Spencer's and then just, you know, walk around the corner and then take it back and you got money. You could write a cheque in Marks and Spencer.
I don't remember doing that, Helen.
Yeah, you could write a cheque. These were the days where you could take things back and get your money back. When you could write a cheque to buy something in the shop and then you could take it back and they would give you cash back for you when you returned the goods, unworn, still in the bag that you'd bought it in.
But this was a resurgence. You had these companies moving in. You had to change from the jute to these really, really good employers. I mean, one of the best of the employers was Michelin, who made the car tyres. You can just imagine after working in these dirty factories on the jute and the production lines in there, these were high technology. They had to be clean. But they also, more than that, they gave lots of benefits to their workers, not just much higher wages, but you had welfare plans, you had sports centres, swimming pools. You know, this was a transformation in the way that work was carried out. It transformed industry in Dundee. And it was such a success story until the pressures of this competition from the Far East began to really grip. And the worst of these to be affected was the Timex company. Bit by bit, they all began to close. But 1993, we have a strike which will go down in history. This was the post-Thatcher years. The trade unions had been broken, the miners had been broken. And in 1993, the Timex management decided that the company was going to be revolutionised. There had to be major changes to pay and conditions. And this really didn't go down well. And the workers at the Timex factory went out on what was to be a long strike, a vicious strike. You know, there were problems at the picket line. And eventually, the workers were broken. They agreed to come back with reduced wages, with fewer workers. But even then, the Timex management didn't uphold it. And so the factory closed. And in 1993, when the factory closed, so many people after that, it had been such a large employer that they really struggled to find work.
Yes, and it wasn't just these bigger companies that were changing. I think I've said that my parents came from Dundee and my grandfather had a dairy in Dundee and his brothers had dairies in Dundee. These were small dairies, you know, delivering milk to small numbers, gradually increasing in numbers. We had in the old days, we used to go out to the farm to get the milk in churns, you know, from the farm road and then bring it back and it would then be, you know, bottled and delivered to the houses. And Jenny would be there washing the bottles by hand. And then I remember the machinery going in, the new conveyor belt going in for the bottling plant and Jenny being replaced by a dishwasher, a bottle washer. But then they've had electric vehicles to deliver the milk because we're all into electric vehicles nowadays, Liz. But back in the sort of 50s and 60s, the milk floats were electric. They were battery run. And, you know, that was fantastic. Before that, it was, you know, a few wee churns on the handlebars of your bicycles cycling along the cobbles. It's a wonder you delivered milk, not butter, at the end of the day. But it was an interesting time of the way changes in technology were moving into very small industries as well.
I'm just talking about dairy. I remember also my great uncle and aunt, Uncle Geordie in Dundee, we would go and visit. And he had worked in the stables of the dairy when they had the horses and carts pulling the milk churns around Dundee. And he was a tiny little man. And I was always fascinated because he had been a jockey and I was very much into my horse riding. And so he would tell stories of the horses that had been in the dairies. So connections with that as well, going back to the good old days of Dundee. But unfortunately, this hope for a high-tech future in these new industrial estates didn't last long. And they saw the writing on the wall. And the town council were very innovative, as they have been all the way through. And in the 1980s, they set up the Dundee Project, which was a collaboration between Dundee District Council, Tayside Regional Council, the Scottish Development Agency, everybody coming together to try to transform Dundee. They had this real vision of what they wanted Dundee to be. They wanted still to attract people in, to invest in them, to develop the industry. But for the first time, they were beginning to see the potential as a centre for tourism, that people might actually want to come and visit this city.
Yes, and it certainly is changing itself. You know, we talked about the Royal Research Ship, the Discovery, and how it came back to Dundee. Well, that was kind of the start of this big city of discovery, or a city of many discoveries that Dundee has become. The people of Dundee welcomed the research ship Discovery back to Dundee in the 1980s. They set up a project, they worked very hard, they completely restored it, and they built a centre alongside it, which gives you the story of Dundee and their research, their voyages out to Antarctica. And the ship itself is just a beautiful, beautiful visit. And alongside that, Liz, they've built many other things, that whole waterfront, which we talked about, shipbuilding and whaling that went on. But that waterfront is developing so beautifully at the moment. It's just a lovely place to be in now.
Yeah, and all of this has very much come on the back of the excellence that they have in academics, in universities and in the research. They've got two universities in Dundee, the traditional University of Dundee that goes back, it was former Polytechnic and became a university in the 1960s, but also the smallest of our universities, the University of Abertay. And close by, we've also got the University of St Andrews. So all this academic research very much fed into this claim that Dundee is the city of discovery. Many discoveries coming out of these ancient, particularly in the area of medical biotechnology and health-related industries coming from the University of Dundee with its links with Nine Wells Hospital in Dundee. And even wee Abertay, I mean, it always got a bad press. It's the smallest of our universities. It was always called DIT because its former name was Dundee Institute of Technology. Everybody looked down their nose at it. It didn't appear well on the university research rankings or anything like that. But it found its little niche. It's not the biomedical or the technology industries. It's in the digital entertainment industry. And if you're into your computer games or your mobile apps or anything like that, then at the heart of it, there's no doubt a graduate of the University of Abertay, because it's really on the map for its digital entertainment research.
Yes, and one of the, it's kind of getting a little bit old hat now, but one of the big games that people will know is Grand Theft Auto.
Yep.
And it sprung out of Abertay University as a student project, I believe, that somebody noticed that it was actually had a good thing and they got it into sort of the commercial world and was Rockstar, the big company formed on the back of that, or they bought it.
Yep, it centres in its headquarters in Edinburgh today. But even today, Abertay and its excellence in digital entertainment, it's using that for the development of this waterfront that you were talking about. This waterfront regeneration project is a huge project. It's over 30 years and it's going to, at the end of it, there's going to be about £1.6 billion invested in this transformation. And it's all focused along what used to be the docklands, you know, where the whales were being melted down and where the ships were being built. Then it fell silent, then it declined and wasted. Now it's being transformed. And the aim, there were several aims of this redevelopment, but largely to provide employment opportunities in offices and also in tourism.
Yes, and of course the names of the docks are still there. We've still got Earl Grey Dock, Queen Victoria Dock, we've got William the Fourth Dock. They're all there, so they're not losing their history. They're trying to keep it and maintain it there in this, and it's beautiful. They've turned one of the docks into the Slessor Gardens, which is a beautiful big square gardens. It's not a park, it's just a big square, but all the little gardens down the side of it and either side have got themes bringing in the story of Dundee, you know, where they traded to, the things they did. It is just lovely, plus a big space for open air entertainment from time to time.
Yeah, they've got new hotels, they've rebuilt the railway station, all of this bringing tourists in to learn about the history of Dundee through these themed gardens and all the rest of it. But the other side of it, they've got these academies, which are ensuring that people who are in the most disadvantaged areas of Dundee, and there's a lot of that, you know, because of its industrial past, they are getting skills in the hospitality industry. The headquarters of the Social Security Service in Scotland is now got its headquarters down there. You talked about Earl Grey. I always thought Earl Grey was to do with the tea clippers and bringing tea in from India. That's what I had learned. But in fact, Earl Grey was a politician and he was very much involved in the Reform Acts that came through. So, of course, he was very popular with the people of Dundee, particularly the women. And that's why one of the docks was named after Earl Grey.
I think it's the Earl Grey Dock that's now a kind of a water park in Dundee. They're using the things as different things, so that's a water park.
And of course, do you remember the Olympia swimming pool? The old Olympia Leisure Centre before the new pool. I remember the days when Jenny, my daughter, was young and she used to go there and we looked after and we shared childcare responsibilities with a friend, and Sarah was a few years younger than Jenny, and Brian would take them both swimming to the leisure centre at Dundee. And it was famous because it had these flumes that you came down, and at the end of it there was this great you came off it at the end and you sailed through the air before you plummeted into the water below. And first time we came down, unbeknown to Brian, it had this this fall at the end of it. Jenny came down, landed in the water, and then thought, oh, what's going to happen to Sarah? She came shooting off the end, fell into the water, resurfaced, Jenny grabbed her, and she came out with a most unladylike quote, which we still use to this day, but she was saved.
Oh, good. Yeah, I remember these flumes. They were red. They came down the outside of the pool, and they were red. That was one of the 1960s buildings that they've very, very, you know, I think part of the brutalist architectural style.
It's all been demolished.
They've demolished these now, plus the building that went up as part of the Dundee Council buildings. That's all been demolished. And in its place has come the most amazing structure, which I think is, you still a little bit, people are thinking, do we like it or do we not like it, called the V&A, Centre of Design in Dundee. It was designed by the architect, who's a Japanese architect called Kengo Kuma, who designed the Tokyo Olympic Stadium. And it is very, very different. I quite like it if you see it at the right angle.
Yeah, I love it. Yep.
It's supposed to represent, well, he says the sea cliffs of the eastern coast of Scotland, but it also looks like two ships being launched into the River Tay, which, of course, takes us back, reflects the history of the docks and the shipbuilding.
Of course, and it's focused on design and Dundee, you know, at the forefront of design. UNESCO named it a city of design in 2014. It was the UK's first city of design. And, you know, UNESCO went back and looked at all the contributions that Dundee has made around the world, the marmalade, the comics, the video games, the design innovations, particularly the Victoria and Albert, the V&A. Which is Scotland's first design museum.
Yes, I was in it last week and I was really a kind of whether or not about it. But having spent a bit more time in it, it is very, very interesting. But what it was housing last week, Liz, was that ties these two episodes together, was the Dundee Tapestry that has just recently been produced, very much built on the lines of the Great Tapestry of Scotland. It is 35 panels telling the story of Dundee. So you've got all the stories of the shipbuilding, the whaling, the jute industries, the linen industries, and then bringing it forward into the Timex, into Levi. It's a wonderful thing. So I thoroughly recommend anybody going. And it was stitched by 120 stitchers from Dundee. So it's very, very local, telling the local story made by local people.
Yeah, been bringing Dundee right to the forefront in the 21st century. You know, one of the trailblazers for attracting tourists to come. It's been hugely successful in this plan to transform Dundee from its previous jutopolis right up to a modern city for the 21st century. And of course, it doesn't stop there because there are still ambitious plans going forward. Dundee plans to have one of the Eden projects based on an old gasworks in the city. And, you know, if anybody knows anything about the Eden projects down at Cornwall, but, you know, what it's doing is to try, it provides a centre which is based on nature and the importance of nature. So they've been hugely successful elsewhere, and it's hoped that this will be a beacon for regeneration and green tourism in Dundee. It's hoped that they'll open that by 2026.
Yes, and all of these things are doing this wonderful job of either reusing, recycling, like the gas tanks, or showing people how they can reuse, recycle, make things out of things. Don't just throw things away. I think these projects are great. And extending the waterfront. It's now a wonderful esplanade walkway along Dundee on this new waterfront, past all these things, incorporating some of the old. You go past a lovely street that's called Chandler Street, which was where all industries to do with shipping were, but they've now transformed that into lovely residential housing using the old buildings that were there. It's lovely.
Yep, so it's a combination of the green space, housing, you know, the particularly the hotels, bars, restaurants that are going to provide such employment, you know, on this waterfront, but also offices, you know, big plans for offices. Mentioned the social security, that's in the Agnes Hubbard, again going back to a suffragette who did so much for women and children in Dundee in the days of Jutopolis. But going full circle, one of the other office blocks is James Thompson House, and it's a proposal for it's being built, £26 million development. And that's going back to remember the city planner James Thompson, and he had this vision right back, you know, when he was building the Cairn Hall in the early 1900s, this vision of what Dundee could look like, and many of the ideas from his vision now being implemented as we get this huge waterfront regeneration.
Yes, and it's really, they've even got a beach in the city, you know, sandy beach in the city, you know, on the esplanade, on the waterfront there. They've just put a set aside an area, filled it with lovely, beautiful, fresh sand, and for the kids to play in. And it's really good. So because there's no beach, the river is too close, it comes right up to the wall, so there's no real beach in Dundee. So they've actually created a beach in the city.
So finishing this up, you know, over 100 years later, we left it at the last episode that we had a vibrant, thriving city. We leave this one after a period of decline. Dundee has come back to be a vibrant, thriving city once again. And we really recommend that you take a guided tour and you visit and you experience for yourself all that's going on in this fourth largest city of Scotland.
Yes, and we must try and have a word of the week, Liz. Have you got one?
Well, I did one to hand when you were talking about this whiskey and champagne running down the streets. You said that people would be going out with a pail to gather it up. I don't think so. I think the people would be lying flat out in the streets having a good sook. They'd be sooking it up, sucking it up.
Yeah, that's a good one, Liz. Well, I was just thinking that my granny used to use a word when she was startled. She'd say, "Oh, he gave me a real flecht. And I think Dundee over time has a couple of wee flechts where it's just kind of had to take itself up, dust itself down and start all over again. So my word is for a fright, a wee start again, a wee flecht.
Very good. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks, Helen. Bye for now.
Thank you very much, Liz. Bye for now, everybody. Bye.
Bye.